Let us begin by a moment of silent meditation, then we'll pray together the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. My name is Jody, and I am an alcoholic. I'm not your chaplain, as was announced from up here the other night. I'm just another drunk up here trying to stay sober one more day. I'm the chairman this morning, but not the chaplain. I want to get that point clear before we get underway here. And you know, all week I've been sitting out there where you are, and people that get up here, you know, and say, "Isn't it great to be here? You know, isn't it great to be here?" Well, I want to say this morning, it's great to be here. It's great to be over here. It's great to be over here. It's great to be out there. What I'm saying is, isn't it great to be alive? I picked that up last night from Steve Martin on Saturday Night Live. I was looking for something I could use, you know, and he just, you know, I heard an AA speaker say not long ago, said, "God gives us what we need when we need it," and I needed it. I was shaving this morning. I cut myself 3 times, and while I was, you know, putting that toilet tissue, you know, all around on my face, somebody came in the room and said, "What's the matter, preacher?" He said, "You're nervous?" I said, "No, I'm not nervous. I always shave with toothpaste and brush my teeth with shaving cream." But it is good to be here. I want to make one or two announcements. I have communion in Lovely Lane Chapel that is directly across over here to the right. All of you are invited to participate in the service of Holy Communion there in the chapel if you so desire before you hit the road. It has been a great week. It is good to be alive. We had a great 17th. It's hard for me to say that. It makes me realize I'm getting on up a few years. I was here at the first one, the second one, and several along the way. I've missed the past few years, but that's my loss, not yours. But it's been great to be here. I was here for the early bird speakers, and I appreciate all you who got up and shared that night with us. You helped me. I'm sure you helped a lot of other people. But when I heard that Tommy Lovern was going to be here, I put everything aside. This became number one on my priority list to be here. Because I love Tommy. He loves me. We've had him down here before. And I had been living in anticipation to hearing his message on Thursday night. And I'll tell you now, I was born again. We hear a lot about born again. Every time I hear Tommy Lovern speak, I get converted all over again. Born again. God, thank you for Tommy Lovern and sending him our way during these days. This man whose health is not what it once was is going the second mile now trying to help alcoholics. And I hope God will give him the strength and the energy, the breath, to continue to carry the message as he has through these many years so effectively. God bless him. And old David, you know, was great. I got a great joy out of hearing David. One of the things he talked about that stayed with me after I left the auditorium, he talked about how you can see it in the eyes, you know. When you get into this AA, how you can see it in their eyes. Well, for several days. Well, have you ever seen a Methodist preacher looking in a Jew's eyes? About the only time I ever remember doing this before, we've got a a fellow, Aaron Cohen, in my town in Americus, Georgia, where I grew up. I've looked in his eyes a few times when I was trying to buy a suit of clothes, you know, but not in this same manner. And I'll say this, David's got it. And I thank God that he has. Thank God that he was willing and able to come down here and share to help us to have a better weekend and to help us to have a better life in the days out there ahead of us. Gracie A. and Sarah P. were good. I know just about everything they said. I wasn't here that morning. I know about everything they said because when I got back from the golf course, people began to tell me, you know, what they said. Said Sarah said it, Gracie said it, and this, that, and the other that morning. I'm sorry I missed it. But I went down to Sea Island to play on the golf course down there. I've been waiting down here 25 years to get an invitation to play the Sea Island golf course. Finally, I got it Saturday morning. And, you know, they say, you know, God will give you what you need when you need it, and I guess I needed that. But it was worth waiting a long time for. I've known Julian a long time, and he always gives me a great thrill to hear him. I've heard one or two of his stories before, and they're always good. They always make me laugh, and I need that. And but Julian brought out something here the other night that I found myself thinking about. He brought out to us how important it is to keep it simple. He talked about Dr. Bob, you know, bringing that out. And I thought about this after I left. When I first came into this fellowship 26 and a half years ago, they were talking a lot about this. Keep it simple. Don't complicate the program. God knows I have, and many of us have been guilty of doing that, trying to complicate the program. And so I leave here with a renewed dedication to trying to keep it simple, keep my life as simple as I can. And I appreciate Julian reminding me to take it easy, too. Because this job I'm on now, I've been about to work myself to death the last 6-8 months, and I needed to hear that, to slow down and live, because tomorrow's going to be good to us, and God's going to be with us, so we need to have no fear. Thank you, Julian. You did a marvelous job, and I'll go away from here a better person because of it. Well, they didn't give me much time this morning, you know, to talk to y'all. I don't know why. I think Dr. John knows. Last time he heard me, I think I talked an hour and 45 minutes. He said, don't talk for 20 minutes. So, the big book tells us that we ought to tell a little bit what it was like, what happened to us, and what it's like now. I can say that in less than 20 minutes, really. I can say it in about 1 minute. What it was like? It was hell. What happened to me? I came into this wonderful fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and got converted. It changed my whole lifestyle. It set me free to do what I had wanted to do all of my life. But I could not because of alcohol. Alcoholics Anonymous helped me tremendously. When I began to make the decision to enter the ministry of the church, Tommy, they began to tell me, no, you've got to go back to college, you've got to go through the seminary and all this. I said, I can't do that. I have a wife and 3 children. I cannot give up my job. Listen to this, friends. Alcoholics Anonymous taught me to never say I can't do anything. They taught me to say, by the grace of God, I'll try. One day at a time. And with that kind of faith, I left my job as engineer on the railroad and entered the ministry of the church. I've never been sorry. But I have a continuing need of this fellowship. Folks say to me almost every week, you think you still have to go to all those meetings to stay sober? And I said, I think I do. I think I do. I'd be afraid, really, to try to leave them off. I don't know. I see some people leaving off the meetings, and they don't make it. So I'm scared, and I keep going to meetings. And I hope God will keep me with that gut feeling, that fear, that knowing fear that I can, you know, the same as anybody else. get back in the gutter again. Well, what is it like now? I can say that in a few words too. It's a hell of a lot better than it used to be. And you better believe it. I don't think my drunkalogue is necessary this morning, because as I look out there, most of you have heard it so many times you could tell it better than I could. But what I'm saying is, I'm here because I need to be here. I'm not down here on a vacation. I came down here seeking and asking and knocking. And I have found. And God has opened some wonderful doors during this weekend. And I'm thankful for that. I'm a Methodist preacher, if some of you have been wondering what I do for a living. Back in the early 60s, I was pastor of the First Methodist Church at Meta for 5 years, from 1961 to 66. We had there then, and we still have there now, a local package shop by the name of T.T.'s. One day I was in the parsonage there, and the telephone rang. And I answered it with just my usual hello. And this feminine voice on the other end said, T.T., would you please send 2 fifths of scotch around to the house before dark? I recognized this lady's voice to be one of my good Methodist ladies. One of my good Sunday school teaching, Bible reading, praying souls. And I thought, well, it'd be a good time to kind of get her straightened out. And I said to her, this is not T.T., this is your pastor. I thought she'd come back and apologize, but instead she came back and said, what in the hell are you doing in T.T.'s package shop? If y'all want a text, there's a preacher or two here. And they like texts, you know, to go with things. This didn't come out of the Bible, but I'm going to give you a little text for this message this morning. I picked it up at what I thought was my first AA meeting. I found out later I had been to some others, but I didn't remember being there. The first one I remember attending, they handed me a little card with the 12 steps of recovery on one side. I turned it over. I doubt if I'd have turned it over, really, if I had realized what a profound effect the words on the other side would have upon me the remaining days of my life. But I turned the card over and read these words. None could tell me where my soul might be. I searched for God, but God eluded me. I sought my brother out and found all three. When I read those words, I realized that here is a simple principle that Jesus taught. One I had learned as a small boy in the Methodist Sunday school in my hometown in America, Georgia. Where Jesus said, if you try to save your life, you're going to lose it. But if you will lose your life for my sake, you'll find it. And it was through literally losing myself in this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that God became a reality in my life. And things started getting better and better. I haven't been like some like Julian. Julian, I haven't made $1 million either. I still don't drive a Cadillac and fly an airplane on. I tried for a long time to get the 11th step to make it do that, though. I used to work on that step, and you know where it says, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God, praying only for a Cadillac and an airplane. But it wouldn't do that. I read it, and I read it, and I read it, and read it, and read it. And every time I read it, it'd say the same thing. Praying only for the knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry that out. Think about it. Well, AA, as I mentioned, set me free. Set me free to do some things I've always wanted to do. And I thank God daily for the 12 steps, for the fellowship, and for each of you. Oftentimes people ask me, say, well, how could God take an old drunken railroad engineer and make a preacher out of it? I don't know. But I think these words of Bishop Ralph Cushman might give you a little insight into how. I met God in the morning when my day was at its best. And His presence came like sunrise, like a glory in my breast. All day long the presence lingered. All day long He stayed with me. And we sailed in perfect calmness o'er a very troubled sea. Other ships were blown and battered. Other ships were sore distressed. But the winds that seemed to drive them brought to us a peace and rest. And then I thought of other mornings with a keen remorse of mind when I too had loosed the moorings with the presence left behind. So I think I know the secret. Learn from many a troubled way. You must seek Him in the morning if you want Him through the day. It's that simple, Julian. If you want to stay sober, why not ask God to help you? It's worked for me for quite a few 24-hour periods. And what God has done for others, I guarantee you, He'll do for you. God bless you and keep you all. We have a great treat in store for us here this morning. You've heard that we are indeed blessed. We are. Got a great blessing here this morning. Speaker that I know you're going to be able to identify with. One that you're going to get a great deal out of. Something you can think about on the way home. And I asked Harry last night, I said, can you tell me several things good about you that I can say, you know? Yeah, sometimes we have to kind of search and look to find something good we can say about an alcoholic. Of course, not so with Harry. I've been knowing Harry a long time. And appreciating him and loving him. Well, three things I want to say briefly about him. One thing, he married his wife Lucille. I don't believe he could have maintained his sobriety through these years without her. Everywhere I've seen him, she's been there to help him. That's one great thing about the speaker. If you have met Lucille, you meet her before you leave here. You'll be a better person. Another thing I say about the speaker is folks up in North Carolina thought so much of him, they sent him up to New York as the delegate. He'd been the delegate. I think this says something about a man's sobriety, the quality of it. And then for 21 years, Alcoholics Anonymous has been blessed by the messages that he has carried all over this land of ours. Another second mile man when it comes to carrying the message. And I thank God for him. As I mentioned, I've known Harry and loved him for a long time. Now, he's from Charlotte. Now, I don't care too much about Charlotte. I'm not going to talk too much about Charlotte. I went up there one time, first time I'd ever been to Charlotte, in 1941. I went up there just to have a few little drinks, you know, and have dinner. And the next thing I knew, I woke up in the Mecklenburg County Jail. They didn't treat me too good in your hometown. So I never have had too good a taste in my mouth for Charlotte. But I've always loved Harry. And so it's my honor and privilege at this time to present to you Harry B. from Charlotte. Help me to welcome him up here.
My name's Harry Barrett, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I got a good notion to sit down now, and then you'd have a successful conference. But I have a feeling that having been here at St. Simon's 16 consecutive years just might help me go through this morning talk, because I have received so much here and given so little, but received so much. I don't want to run over time, so I'm going to pull out this watch, but it kind of reminds me of the story who the Catholic and the Protestant went to a boxing match, and this Protestant wasn't familiar with Catholic religion and all, and he saw one guy in the corner make the usual sign of the cross, and the Protestant whispered, says, "What does that mean?" Says, "It doesn't mean a damn thing if he can't hit." So, this doesn't mean much, but I'll have it out here in front of me anyhow, John. I'm a big book boy. By that I mean this. I feel like the instructions for my sobriety and my recovery are in the first 11 chapters of the big book. And I don't want anyone to leave because they think that I'm going to read the big book to them. I don't have time to do that. But I believe in chapter 5, wholeheartedly, 100%, and I've often referred to Chapter 5 as the Constitution of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I suppose that's because I'm a little prejudiced or biased. I have received more from that one chapter than any other one chapter. And Chapter 5 tells me that when I'm here in front of a lectern, that I am to tell you how it was, what it was like, how I got here, and what it's like now. And I'll be quite honest with you, ladies and gentlemen, if I had my rather, so to speak, I would much prefer to tell you what it's like now, what AA has done for me in the grace of God, in this beautiful God-given, God-blessed, and God-inspired program, as opposed to a drunk-a-law. But I don't classify myself as one of these so-called intellectuals that Julian was talking about last night. By the way, Tommy Lovin warned me. He says, don't try to out-intellectualize Julian. Well, I'm going to tell you how it was. I could tell you how it was in one phrase if I had to do, and if I had about 30 seconds to do it. And I would borrow it from Chapter 5 again. Self will run riot. You know, I think that we get to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous in two general ways. One, I have heard many people at lecterns like this say they started drinking and they drank for X number of years, 5, 8, 10, 12, sometimes more, with control, so-called social drinking. And then I've heard many others say, I was a born alcoholic. Well, now, I don't know whether I was a born alcoholic or not, but in taking my inventory, I do know this. That I had all of the personality traits, whether inherited or otherwise, of every alcoholic that you've ever heard anything about. Therefore, my trouble started early. Incidentally, I'm a Baptist by birth, and I'm going to kind of talk about the Baptists a little bit up here, because I don't know anything else to talk about. In my early childhood, I, like many of you, went to the routine, BYPU and what have you. And at the age of 15, though, after winning a football game over at Rockingham, I'm from Hamlet. Hamlet grew more drunks per population than any town in North, South Carolina, or Georgia. Last year, I asked everybody from Hamlet to stand up, and it was 14 of them stood up. You remember that? Then that's half the town. Now, I would have been an alcoholic irrespective of place of birth. At the age of 15, I challenged the town athlete after a few drinks of homebrew and White Lightning. And this is in Prohibition days, and he threw me from one side of that street to the other in front of that Purity Cafe, and I landed in jail, and I called my mother Sunday morning. She was getting ready to teach a Sunday school class, and I said, Mama, will you come down here and get me out of jail? And she said, now, Harry, I can't believe you're in jail. What do you mean? I thought you spent the night with Everett. I said, no, Mama, I didn't, and I'm in jail, and you have to get me out. She said, well, I just can't believe it. Well, Mama, whether you believe it or not, it takes $13.50. Please come. And she did. And I know what the clang and the cold clang of a jail door sound, because I made many of them. And she thought that if I went to a Baptist school that I wouldn't drink, you know. So I went to Wake Forest 3 years, got in some trouble there. Don't have time to tell you about that. And I've always considered Georgia, something like FDR did, as my second home. And I transferred from Wake Forest down to another Baptist institution called Mercer University at Macon. And I entered the law school down there, and my second year, somehow, Jim Pilcher, there goes his anonymity, he can verify this, I got involved in politics, and now I'm going to ask you a question. Any self-respecting alcoholic, you know, we are we always want to be tops, and guess what office I was running for? Top office, president of student body. Second year as a transfer student. And had a brilliant roommate. He was valedictorian of Miami High and 1 year ahead of me in law school. And he wrote me out a beautiful speech. He had to make a talk in chapel those days. And I never shall forget it. I practically memorized it. And I went in there that day and made that talk. The old professor came up and says, Mr. Barrett, says, I want to congratulate you. That is one of the finest student talks I have ever heard in my 15 years at the university. Boy, I stuck out my chest a little bit, you know. Says, moreover, I want to congratulate you on winning the election. And I said, well, professor, today's Friday. The election isn't till Monday. He said, yeah, but I heard your opponent, and says, you got this thing by a landslide. Now, there was a lot of ministerial students at Mercer at that time. And I started celebrating. Any self-respecting alcoholic would. This victory, you know, that I had won. And Friday night I got drunk, and Saturday afternoon I was in the jug, and Saturday night I heard that some of my fraternity brothers were down on Oak Street. And Oak Street at that time was in the red light district. Now, I don't want any of you ladies to get the wrong impression. I went down there to look after my fraternity brothers because I never got to the boudoir. I passed out by the Nickelodeon in the living room. So, alcohol is giving me trouble early. I lost the election. You know, those narrow-minded Baptists frowned upon that. They took a very dim view of my conduct. Well, I managed to graduate in 1939. My father sent me the money to stand the bar exam and to take a 6-week cram course. And I was courting so hard and drinking so much that I never made the first class of the cram course. So I've always told my AA audiences with absolute candor that you're looking at one who didn't pass the bar because he couldn't pass a bar. And that's the way it is. Jody, I got a fine job as a claim agent with a Seaboard Airline Railroad, and it was the highest paying job of my graduating law class, frankly. And I was on my way. Except they have Jody might be familiar with this, a thing called Rule G in railroad vernacular and terminology. And Rule G is, if you are drinking on or off the job, why, you can be terminated. And I was terminated in a very short while, about a year and a half. And at the time, I knew about an opening in New York City, and I was ambitious to get up there and see how they operated, you know, in Yankee Land. And sure enough, my boss, he wrote down a beautiful letter of recommendation, even though he was firing me. He said I'd get along fine up there. Those people had high balls at noontime. And he just thought I'd get along fine. I couldn't work for him, but off to New York in the soft lights and music in the bars I went. And in another short time, a year and a half later, I was getting ready to go in the service of the Fighting Coast Guard. Incidentally, I fought the Battle of Staten Island with the Navy in the bars. But I was drinking down the old Commodore, and I remember Vaughn Monroe was there. And none of you are old enough to remember. We used to call him Nasal Voice Racing on the Moon. And he was down there, and I was getting ready to leave, and my boss informed me in no uncertain terms that he hoped I'd seek another career when I got back. In fact, he acted like he didn't care whether I got back or not. And I have since figured that out, why he felt that way. He said that my drinking had become a problem. And he just didn't appreciate me dating his married daughter. Well, hell, everybody else was dating her. I thought it was all right for me to date her. But it wasn't. And 3 years and 3 months later, when I got out of the service, why, he sent me to what I call Siberia. That's Rochester, New York, up on the lake. And by golly, it started snowing in 1st of November, and I didn't even see the ground till the last of March. That was 1945, and I tell you, it was rough. There again, I was to lose my job, and in the meantime, I was having blackouts. This is a progressive illness. If there's any new people here, there's one thing I can be very positive about. I can even get dogmatic and say, if you continue to drink, it will get worse and worse. I have seen it over and over again. So I'd already had my blackouts, and then this was during the McCarthy era, and somehow I was having these hallucinations by now. It had progressed to this degree. And my favorite hallucination, Jody, was that those officials down there at that railroad were communists. And one night, about 3 o'clock in the morning, I decided that it was my patriotic duty to go down there and run those communists off. And, of course, I started with the chief dispatcher and train master and worked up, Jody, to the general superintendent. And do you know who they ran off? You're looking at it. I remember the next day they came by. They took all my passes. And they had a man from New York, one from Buffalo, and one from Rochester. It took 3 to fire me. Don't you ever apply for another job with any railroad in the United States. And damn if they didn't add or Canada. You know, I felt somewhat like a prodigal, I believe, felt. I had 6 years after graduation from law school, unemployable, in the snow in a foreign country, as far as I was concerned. I didn't know what to do. But I hated to go home and face my parents an utter, absolute, total failure. I just couldn't do it. My sense of pride or what have you wouldn't let me. And I stayed up there for a while. And I answered a newspaper ad, and I found myself peddling vacuum cleaners in the snow on the sidewalks in Rochester. And I've always said that's a pretty far cry from Clarence Darrow, the vacuum cleaner salesman. And I told Dad one summer, though, it sure wasn't going to snow on me again in Rochester. And he said, "What do you mean?" And I said, "Well, Dad, I'm going to seek a career as an insurance adjuster." And he'd been with the railroad many years as an engineer, Jody, and he said, "Hey, I hate to see you leave the railroad. Hell, I'd been writing him on legal stationery for 3 years. And I came back to Raleigh, and now I knew why I had lost these jobs. And I thought by getting back home around my home environment, etc., grits and cornbread and rice and gravy and what have you, that this would curtail my drinking. Now, I didn't want to stop, but I wanted to stop having trouble and stop losing jobs. And I must say by this time I had abandoned anything godly and anything spiritual. Up to that time, as far as romance was concerned, I had lost the girl I was engaged to at Macon. And my life began to be a series of continuous, ill-fated romances. And that has a point, and I'll bring it out a little later. And they sent me to Newbern and Wilmington, and after 11 months, I was in the home office in Raleigh on the carpet again, being fired. I never will forget what he said. He let me down a little easy. He said, "You know, they tell me that I got a letter here to you, the best casualty adjusters they've ever had." I don't know how many golfers is in the audience, but he said something about a tee to tee, and I thought he was talking about golf. But what he said they don't need a tee-to-tee worker Tuesdays through Thursdays. I was always absent on Mondays and Fridays. And they didn't need a part-time adjuster. So here I am. And I could almost read the handwriting on the wall by this time when I was going to get my papers fired. And I said, "Mr. Green, I have permission to use his name." I said, it's a lot easier to get a job if you have a job. And I said, won't you just be tolerant enough to let me come in the office and be your office clean man? I'll blow my breath in your face every morning. And if you smell one iota of alcohol, you can write out my check right there. But just give me a little time until this application's processed. He said, well, hey, who's going to hire you? And I told him, I said, well, it's the U.S. Department of Labor, Wage and Hour, and Government Contracts Division. And he smiled. He said, well, that makes it different. And I said, well, what do you mean? Oh, he says, I was OPA administrator for 2 years in Raleigh here. And says, I stayed drunk 365 days a year, and I believe you can hold down a job with the government. I've always said that's the last refuge of retreat for an incompetent alcoholic lawyer with the U.S. government. Well, they were the most tolerant employer I ever had. I got arrested for drunken driving, and I rather excelled in criminal law, about the only thing I did excel in the whole law course. And I knew how to beat that charge. I got 3 witnesses to lie for me, and I lied myself. And they transferred me to Charlotte. And just before they transferred me, I want to tell you this. It's an integral part of my story. My dad came to me and said, Harry, your drinking's got so bad, you're digging out grave. So your mother and I can't stand it any longer. We want you to move out. And I didn't know anything about the illness of alcoholism. And with all the earnestness at my command, I turned to Dad and looked him straight in the eye. And I said, Dad, you have given me 2 warnings. And I want to tell you, I love you, and I know y'all love me. And if you'll give me 1 more chance, I'll make good. And Mother looked at him and says, I believe he means it this time. And Dad says, okay. And he was in the baseball season, but he says, 3 strikes and you're out. And 11 or 12 days from then, I was drunk 3 days in my own home. And my parents had to ask me to exit. In shame and disgrace. When in Charlotte, I met Lucille shortly afterwards and up in Hickory. And, of course, I began a rather whirlwind courtship. And after about 3 months, I had drank some, you know, before dinner and so forth. But she had a smart-aleck cousin who worked for the FBI in Charlotte. And this cousin took a trip all the way from Charlotte to Hickory to tell her about this government lawyer who was, quote, a sot. Well, now, in all due respect to Lucille, God bless her, she hadn't been married either at this time. And we were the same age, namely 38. And, well, she asked me about the drinking. And of course, I told her that I took a few drinks before dinner and had a few drinks occasionally. And you've seen me have a few. But I'll tell you one thing. If that bottle ever comes between us, the bottle will have to go. Because my love for you is greater than any bottle. Them are last words. But you know, she didn't want to lose this prize package. And so she was going to reform me anyhow. And she wanted to believe it, and by gosh, she did believe it. But I made sure that I got knee-walking, passing out drunk 3 times before we get married, so she could never say I didn't know he drank. And we got married, and this illness progressed very, very rapidly, as it always does. And he got so disgusted that he decided that it's time I was giving some counsel. And he picked the right man for me. It was Dr. George Heaton, who was pastor of the Mice Park Baptist Church at that time. And he had a TV program every Monday, and he was the smoothest talker I'd ever heard. And I used to see him at Mice Park Country Club after a golf game, you know, watching the boys drink and gamble. And it didn't seem to bother him a bit. And I thought to myself, man, this is the most open-minded Baptist preacher I'd ever seen. And when she asked me to go to see Dr. Heaton, who had the greatest reputation in Charlotte at that time for counseling alcoholics, etc., whatever your problem was, he was the answer. And I immediately agreed. See, I played a little football, and I knew that the best defense was a good, hard-charging offense, and I went there for one reason. Get Lucille off of my cotton-picking back. And the minute Dr. Heaton mentioned alcohol, I jumped up out of my chair and pointed my finger at him. I said, now, just a minute, Dr. Heaton, let's stick to the real issue here. He says, pray tell me, what's the real issue? Well, says, it's my neurotic wife. He said, that calls for an explanation. I said, you're going to get it. And Jody, I proceeded to tell them that her grandfather was a Methodist minister. And that he taught the children and every grandchild to take one little thimble full of alcohol with sin. He said, you don't say. I said, the hell I don't. He called Lucille in, and I never shall forget what he told us. He said, Lucille, I've heard your story, and I've heard Harry's story. And, you know, he asked me how much I drank. I told him the same thing I told Lucille. It worked with her. I figured it worked with him. Biggest lie I've ever told. He said, Lucille, I've talked with Harry and I've talked with you. And he said, if he ever becomes an alcoholic, you know, I'm going to recommend Alcoholics Anonymous because some of the finest members of my congregation are members of AA. And I didn't hear that very clear, but the last part of that sentence I heard, then he started over and said, until he becomes an alcoholic. You see, Lucille hated this stuff so, and I was uncomfortable, and I'd always heard that a man's home was his castle. And I told Dr. Heaton, I said, Dr. Heaton, I can't drink in the living room, I can't drink in the dining room or the kitchen, I've got to go to the attic or the basement or the garage to have one little drink. He said, you don't mean it. And he told Lucille that he used to have his drinks wherever he pleases, anywhere in the house, kitchen or otherwise. And I said, thank you, Dr. Heaton. Kids closed. We walked out. And it got worse, 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 worse. And downhill I'm going, and Lucille got in the hospital for a period of some 28 or 30 days. And my friends, up to this point, my drinking was primarily on weekends. I was a weekend binge boy. And I didn't drink during the week when I was working. But it got to the place I couldn't get to work, as you know, and as I've described, until Tuesday. And when she got in the hospital, I was drinking, and the first thing you know, I found out I was drinking not only on weekends, but I was drinking around the clock. And I couldn't go to work, and I couldn't do anything. In fact, there were a few days that I couldn't even get over to the hospital and say, how are you today? And I regret to tell you that there were a few 24 hours that passed that I was so sick that I couldn't reach out to this bedside phone and dial Presbyterian Hospital and say, how are you today? And I became so despondent, full of despair. I became hopeless and helpless. Guilt and remorse took over in fear. And I just didn't know what to do. And at the end of this 28 days, I concluded I can't quit drinking. And I tried every way, everything. I might as well kill myself. You see, I became so full of absolute, total helplessness, hopeless, despondency, and despair, HHDD, that I lost the will to live. Life held absolutely nothing for me. And in a blackout, calling this Dr. Broach, who was incidentally from Athens, at St. John's Baptist Church, and I hadn't been to church in many a day. I was always hung over on Sunday, threatening suicide. And one Sunday, I don't know what caused this. I can't explain it, but maybe you can understand it. In this helpless, hopeless state of mind, I decided, well, maybe it'll help to go to church. And I hadn't been to church in many a day, and I had abandoned everything bodily and everything spiritual. My God had become the bottle, everything wrapped around the bottle. But I staggered over there, literally. He's about 6 feet, 4 or 5, got his arm as long as from here to John Mooney. And there was an old biddy, if you'll pardon the expression, that was smelling my alcoholic breath, evidently, and as she got near the preacher, she turned around and said, things like that ought not be allowed in here. And he just smiled and said, when things like that aren't allowed in here, I won't be here either, lady. Harry says, will you wait there just a minute, the side door? I was sneaking out the side. When the last parishioner left the front, in the main entrance, he walked over to the side entrance and he asked me a $64 question. What are you going to do about your drinking? And I stammered and stuttered and shed a tear to Tommy. Tommy said he wouldn't give a plug nickel for a man who couldn't. I remember him telling me that many years ago. I gave no answer I knew to give at that time. I don't know. He said, well, I hate to see you kill yourself, but you are on a road of self-destruction. You may do it fast. Or it could be slow. See, I talked to him about a year before, and I wouldn't promise him that I'd quit. But he told Lucille to stick around and stick with me, to be patient, try to understand that he believes someday I'd just might have whatever it took to quit. And he didn't believe that I wanted to become the kind of person I had become. He saw more in me than I did or anybody else at that time. And so he asked me again, what are you going to do about your drinking? Same answer. The only one I knew to give at that time, I don't know. Why don't you try Alcoholics Anonymous? And in desperation and semi-clarity, I stammered, yeah, I'll try anything. You see, I didn't know that this good man had been invited by one of his deacons some 10 days before to attend an open meeting. He'd been to one meeting, and he knew, he perceived, he was a man of knowledge, that you people and this program was the answer for Harry Barrett. And that's what he recommended. And I started going to meetings, and I never will forget the first meeting. I liked what I saw and what I felt. And I did see this look in their eyes that you've heard so much and you're going to hear a little more about it. And two or three fellas shook my hand and said, if you got a problem drinking, said, you're in the right place. And I never will forget one of them came up to me and said, Harry, says, if you're lonely, you'll never have to be alone again. Boy, what good news. What good news. I started going to meetings. And at the end of 8 months, I had not opened this big book. I had heard the 12 steps in one ear and out the other. And I was what you call about a half step man. The first step, I think I did about half of it. But the thing that got me, you keep telling me it's the first drink that makes you drunk, and I was just arrogant enough and egotistic enough to think that I'll be the first one to prove every damn one of you wrong. Now, I didn't have a slip. I drove down to the liquor store willfully, intentionally, and with much fault. All stinking thinking. Foolish, yes. But it's not a slip. Because I looked up in the dictionary what a slip was after I slipped for some 3 months. Said to slip on a banana or an orange peel. And I ended up drunk in the orange bowl, but I didn't even slide a slip down there. Now, after 3 months of absolute total hell on earth, this suicide syndrome came back. And I saw no reason to continue. On January the 31st, I called my sponsor, Bob Rankin, in Gastonia, and I asked him if he'd come over the next day. He said, will you be drinking? And I said, no, I will not. I've had it. He says, I believe you mean it. I'll be there. And he came. Thank God he came. And he told me, he said, Harry, you know I resented this for many months. He said, you're sicker than most. Who, me? Yes, said you. Says, 2 meetings a week. Didn't do it for you. You better double it or make it 5 a week if you're going to really get serious with the program. And the third thing he told me was this. By the way, what step were you working on when you decided to return to drink? Now, you know, folks, that's a hell of a question, isn't it? And you give me just enough threadbare honesty to tell him, not a damn one. And that was the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. And he left, and I decided that if I was sicker than most, there's no way I could take 12 steps in 12 days and say what's next. And so it's February the 1st, 1958, which is my 21st birthday, just passed. And I decided, well, maybe I ought to take these steps by the calendar month. And since I'll give myself the benefit of the doubt on the first step, heaven knows I was powerless over alcohol. Time and time I had proved my life totally unmanageable in all three areas, socially, home, and business. So I'll start with the second step. Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. My friends, I never had any trouble with the term sanity. Because it wasn't the crazy things I did when I was drinking. It was the continuing to try to drink successfully and getting into trouble every time. That's where the insanity was. Everybody does crazy things when they're drunk. Now came step three. Made a decision to turn my will and life over to care of God as I understood it. And on page 63 under How It Works, H is for honesty, O is for open-minded, W for willingness. You see? I'd got honest, I was open-minded, and I'd become willing to go to any length. And you know, a lot of people, and this isn't criticism, this is just an observation. It's like somebody said last night, if I'm criticizing, I've got three fingers pointed at me. And make a big deal out of this step three. Here it is. It says, we're now at step three. Why don't we do what the big book tells us to do? I submit that to you. Many of us said to our Maker as we understood him, God, I offer myself to thee to be with me and do with me as thou wilt. Receive and relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Gosh, I read a little further over here on page 69 or 68. Quote, this isn't what Harry Barrett says, this is what the big book. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it's the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate to us what he can do. Beautiful. And at the end of March, I had read everything I could on step three or pertaining to turning my will over to care of God. I want to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, friends, I had a good feeling inside. As good or better feeling inside as I've ever had in my entire life, 43 years. A good feeling inside. So I went on with the step by the calendar month. It took me months to take my inventory. And with different people to take step five. And I got step 11. Talk to prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God. Praying only for knowledge of his will for me and the power to carry that out. That has become, over the years, my favorite step. I think we all might have a little favorite step. And it told me very positively and very definitely on step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. You see, this is a guarantee that I'll have a spiritual awakening. And through God's grace, I do. We tried to carry this message. What message? Message of sobriety? First step is a message of sobriety. How about the remaining 11? Huh? Spiritual message, certainly that's what it is. This message refers to these previous 11 steps. It couldn't be any other way. And that's why they tell you, working with others, which I've had the God-given privilege of working with many. And many of you know that who know me. They say to tell them, don't hesitate, your concept of God. I don't care. I ran into just 3 weeks ago, a man told me he was an atheist. And I've been referred to him. I still told him my concept was that. And then I said, I'll tell you what I want you to do. I want you to go to chapter 4, to the agnostic. And I want you to underscore the things in that chapter that appeal to you. And I said, I've already got mine underscored here, and I showed it to him in my book here. I've got it underscored, and I said, we're going to compare notes. And you know, we did this, and about 50% of the things I had underscored, he did. And the next meeting, when they said the Supreme Prayer, I noticed he got up and said the Supreme Prayer. And the next meeting, when they closed the meeting, praise God, he said the Lord's Prayer as loud as anybody there. Thank God. It's a program of growth. It's a program of love. It's a program of understanding. Let me tell you some of the beautiful things, my time's getting short, that happened as a result of these 12 steps. I told you a while ago, I can tell you how it was in one sentence. Seth will run right. AA not only has enabled me to put the cork in the bottle, don't you know that, think about this, if AA hadn't given me more than physical sobriety, that I wouldn't have stayed around for 21 years? No. But I don't want and never had thought I could graduate. It's a program of growth, and I hope I'll stay teachable. And I say this sincerely. I've lost any ambitions for money and for power. I only have one desire, as God sees fit, to let me stay with you and be a part of you, because you are my kind of people. You see, God taught me, and this program taught me, that receiving, as I did for all my life before I came to AA, wasn't it. But giving was it. And I was so selfish that I was always on the receiving end. Always on the receiving end, Raymond. I didn't know what it was to give, and therefore I didn't know really how to live. And so these 12 steps opened up channels of new and better living. I promise you, I won't read but one more thing. It's in the second edition. This thing's worn out. I've got to get a binder or something to cover this thing. It's on page 507. Here it is. That's all I'm going to read. They taught me the most important lesson I have ever learned in my entire life. Now that's saying something, isn't it? Huh? The most important lesson I ever learned in my entire life. And I can say that. That is that AA doesn't need me, but I need AA very desperately, very humbly, and very sincerely. Not all at once. You don't get it all at once. Just a little bit at a time. Thank the Lord. They told me that you got to get out and work a little, and you've got to give. They told me that giving was living, living was loving, and loving was God. Isn't that beautiful? It's beautiful to me. And you don't have to worry about God, because he's sitting right in front of your eyes and right next to you. I love that paragraph. Well, some of the good things that's happened to me is the restoration of love and understanding of the families. But first, I think the first thing I ever got from you people was hope, spelled with a capital H. And the second thing, I know I felt free because I had been in bondage to alcohol for 27 years in ever since.
I wouldn't give you 2 cents for one drink or two drinks. From the very beginning, I had to get high as a proverbial Georgia pine or drink. And I had a new freedom to cause. You see? You really enlightened me. You told me that I had a choice, that I didn't have to drink. How many of us thought when we got here or before that we had to drink? That's all of us. You told me, no, you don't have to drink. You can choose not to drink. So I got this new freedom. I certainly got a new faith. And I got a clean conscience instead of this sense of guilt and remorse. But looking at it in reverse, I'm glad the pain of guilt and remorse and total loss of self-respect was so deep. If it hadn't been, I might not have got over to that church that day, and I would have missed out completely and totally. And if I had it to do over, and I know there may be some new people here that don't understand this, I didn't the first time I heard it, that I'm glad I'm an alcoholic. If that's what it took to bring me to the God-given, God-blessed fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, then I'm glad I'm an alcoholic. If I had to go through the pain, the misery, and the heartaches again, I'd do it for what you've given me and for what I've received today. Believe me. I'm grateful, and I think when the person says he's grateful, I kind of like saying with faith, have faith. Faith without works, as far as I'm concerned, is nil. And gratitude to me means action. What can you do to help the suffering alcoholic? And I have a grateful heart today because what you, the God of my understanding that I found in the fellowship of AA, has given me. A little bit about peace of mind. Somebody mentioned peace Union last night. What's peace of mind? We probably have 100 different definitions. Permit me to give you mine. Peace of mind to me represents two absolute things that are necessary in my life to have peace of mind, and only two. And that's peace with God, as I found him in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and peace with you, my fellow man. And I guarantee you, if I have peace with my Creator, my Maker, God, and I have peace with you, I have peace with him. We're made in three dimensions: physical, mental, spiritual, body, mind, soul. And I know one thing. Some may agree and some may disagree, and that's your privilege. But it's my privilege to say this. God placed a limitation on me as far as physically. I could have never been an All-American football player. In junior, I couldn't have been an Einstein either. He placed a positive limitation on my mental faculties. But as I stand here today, beautiful water, beautiful trees, and this lovely setting, you see all of God's handiwork. He didn't place any limitation on my spiritual growth. He will permit me to grow spiritually just as much as I decide I want to link up with him in the center of my life. And I know this. And I hope you do too. Restoration of love of family. This dad and mother that asked me to leave home in Raleigh, I told Dad one time that I got more spiritual food from AA than I did the church. And Tommy, believe me, I wasn't nothing to church. I was singing the praises of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, I don't understand that. And you know, I didn't argue with him until he was stubborn as I was, dear. 3 months later, they had a convention. Some of you may have been there in Raleigh. And I left Charlotte and went to Raleigh, and I asked Dad on a Sunday afternoon for an open meeting, would you like to go with me? And it was hot, and it was in midsummer, and he put on that Panama Star, and I knew what he was thinking. He wanted to see what you folks had that he could change this eldest son of his, the oldest of three boys. He said, yeah, I'd like to go. And so down to the end of Fayetteville Street, Memorial Stadium, and there was an open meeting. And they had a fellow from Pennsylvania, and I can't break his name, it was Dick Klein, who run the Chit Chat Farms. Dedicated, devoted, in love to the alcoholic, ran this farm for recovering alcoholics. Excuse me. He took his subject that afternoon, am I my brother's keeper? What a subject. When we came out of that meeting, my dad put his arms up around my shoulders. He said, hey, in spite of all the heartaches and the misery your drinking caused, I'm going to tell you one thing. You've more than made up for it since you've been in AA. Oh, what a blessing to hear that for one who had caused him so much trouble, so much misery, and so much heartache. He said, I felt the presence of God in your meeting, and I now know what you were talking about a couple of months ago when you were visiting us. He loved you so much that about 2 blocks from our residence in Raleigh, he went to an open meeting at the Hayes Barton Group, sometimes referred to as the Rug Group. And those people in there were kind to him. They knew why he was there. You see, he was there because you had restored to him his eldest son. And no other reason, just sheer gratitude to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me tell you a little bit about my mother. She died 2 years ago. 87 years old. And I say a few things in no bragging way because I had nothing to do with it, but she was a lifetime deaconess in the First Baptist Church for many years and taught a Sunday school class all her life until her hearing got impaired and she dropped down. And I thank God that in 1962, maybe some of you were there, I invited them to the state convention in Charlotte. They heard every one of the talks, and they met you people, and the great late Dr. Sam Shoemaker was the speaker Sunday afternoon. What a friend we had in Sam, the first theologian to really recognize the true value and to help Bill Wilson concepts of the 12 steps. He never took credit for writing the 12 steps. He always gave it to Bill. But you know and I know, anyone that reads the history of AA, that Dr. Sam Shoemaker was probably the greatest outside non-AA friend this fellowship has ever had. And after we got home that afternoon, my mother made a rather startling statement. It almost shocked me. Because she was so devoted to the church. She said, you know, says, I changed my mind about something. And I said, what's that, Mama? She said, well, says, I used to say that happiest people on earth were church people, but You know, I believe that the happiest people I've ever seen, I saw them at these meetings. And again, I asked Mama, what makes you think so? And she said, I saw it in their eyes. And I felt it in their hand clasp. And I said, Mama, you know, I agree with you. I won't argue that point at all. She said, well, I don't understand. I said, well, maybe I can just give you a partial explanation. You church folks are good folks, most of it. And I meant that. I'm sincere. I said, you certainly haven't lived the life of hell on earth that the alcoholic has lived. And y'all call it conversion. I said, we just call it a new way of life. A new way of life. But I said, there's a recovering alcoholic in the fellowship. I said, I have my favorite verse in the Bible. Mama, I said, you forgot more Bible than I've ever known. And boy, I told the truth. But I said, 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 17 says, therefore any man in Christ is a new creature. Behold, old things have passed away. All things have become new. I said, this is AA today, Mama. You know, old things have gone by the wayside, and all things have become new. She said, that has to be the answer. She, as a member of Al-Anon, made the first Blue Ridge Conference. And she had such a joyous time up there. And then later on my 12th birthday, I'm getting ready to close here. Lucy and I couldn't decide who was going to give me my chip. She had given me my chip, and some of the older than my sponsor had died, and so on and so forth. Mother was visiting with us, and Lucille, God bless her, she's been with me from the very beginning. And Jody, I couldn't have stayed sober and recovered without her and the fellowship of Alan, and I don't think I could. And she's a lot smarter than I am, or else she just doesn't talk as much. And so she said, how about letting Mama give it to you? I said, it's a good idea. And I asked Mother to give it. She said, smile. She said, oh, so I'd love to. And so they let somebody else give out the preliminary chips. And then Mother got up and she stood just like this at a lectern like this with people like you at the Queen City group in Charlotte and says, I think this is one of the greatest privileges that's ever been accorded me to give Harry his 12 years of sobriety chip, but says I can't take any real responsibility for it. Says you, the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, are responsible for this, and I sure want to thank you. And then she said in a quiet voice, but audible, I want to thank you for the changes that I've seen wrought in his life. And you could have heard a pin drop. And she gave him a chip, and I stood up there blubbering and crying. I'm a sentimental slob. But there were tears of joy. Tears of joy. And I couldn't say thank God and thank AA and thank her, and so I sat down and I'm sure many of my well-meaning friends had a few comments after that, and the one that I heard, well, that's the first time that SOB was I've ever seen him speechless. Okay, let me say one word about my sponsor, the guy that said, which step were you working on when you decided to drink? And then he said, if you want to recover. He didn't say if you want to get dry. He didn't say if you want to get sober. He said if you want to recover from your illness. This denotes something above physical sobriety. You better make the steps an important part of your life. This is what he told me, thank God. He'd been sober about 4 years and he's contacted pancreatitis, and I looked it up in the medical dictionary and it said severe infection of the pancreas gland, sometimes fatal. And I saw this man who had borrowed my gun to go to Hilton Head Island on some hunts. A man's man, 185 pounds, 6 feet tall, good. Down, down, down. In the last week that he was living, I was the only one that was permitted to visit him in Gaston Memorial Hospital other than his immediate family. They thought enough of me, and he thought enough of me. They arranged it that way, and I'm thankful for that. And some 3 or 4 nights before he passed away, I was there, and he was in full possession, folks, of his mental faculties. But he'd gone down between 100 and 110 pounds, skin and bones, but had it all up here. Just as I started to leave, he says, "Hey, shake my hand." And I reached out, Bill, and clasped his hand as one AA does to another. And he looked at me, and a faint smile parted his lips. And he says, "Stay in AA and remember, I love you." And this was the first man that ever told me that he loved me. And I have never forgotten it, and I don't want to forget it. Because I have thought many, many times since, is there any force on earth any greater than the love of one alcoholic for another? I don't think so. I thank my Heavenly Father every night for giving you the capacity to love me and for giving me the capacity to love you every night. I'm closing with something I borrowed from Savannah when I was at Hilton Head some 15 years ago. Minnie O'Brien gave me a little thing, and I think it was called The Miracle of AA or How It Works. Anyhow, I liked it, and Lucille and I worked on it a little bit, you know. Changed a little word or two. It's a little poem. But my friends, it expresses what happened and how it is now. And I'm saying to you that it so aptly, I loved it enough to memorize it. It tells you how my drinking was, and it tells you how my recovery is. And the jury's still out. You be the judge. I drank up, my friends, felt so blue, hated myself, knew not what to do. Dreaded to face the light of each day, not wanting to hear what people would say. Like, where's your willpower and pride? They didn't understand deep down inside. I wish I had the answer to give and how to find the courage to live. They gave me the pills I should have and told me to see the doctors I should, but they did no good. I made many promises and meant not to lie, but the compulsion to drink was stronger than I. One day, a friend happened to say, "I know the answer. I'll show you the way. All it takes is an open mind. Believe what you hear from one of your kind." We went to a meeting. They read chapter 5. The steps made sense and hope was revived. I saw living proof that faith was the key. It worked for them. Why not for me? One day at a time, they told me to live. Easy does it. Learn to forgive. Be honest. Be humble. Help when you can. Pass on what you learned to a new man. I heard them pray the serenity prayer and soon realized all my answers were there. Now when someone asks, "Can miracles be?" may I always reply, "Take a look at me." Thank God for AA and thank you for listening.
You will remain standing, please. Join hands and we'll close the meeting by praying together the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and glory, forever and ever. Amen.